Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today we're talking about genetic testing and research. It's a topic on many of your minds because of recent news out of Washington. The Preserving Employee Wellness Programs Act, H.R. 1313, passed out of a U.S. Congressional House committee last week before raising a stir in the form of public opinion. The legislation is accused of trying to strip privacy protections from the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. We'll talk about the politics of all that and the impact on privacy later and on future programs of In the Moment. But before we unpack those politics, we wanted to know, what are we even talking about when we talk about genetics? What's possible and what's at stake? With us now via phone is genetics researcher Dr. Cornelius Burkle. He's executive director of Sanford Imagenetics Research Center on Genomic and Molecular Medicine and executive clinical director of Sanford's Genetics Laboratories. Dr. Burkle, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you.
All right, are you okay if I don't ask you about politics and we just talk about genetic research for a bit so we're all have an understanding of what we're even talking about here?
I'm very happy with that.
All right, so give me a little historic perspective. Where does this kind of research begin and how far has it come in recent years?
Well, genetics research began quite a while ago, in the 1800s, and probably could be traced back to the late 1700s, and arises out of a cultural understanding of procreation. So in essence, genetics is the understanding of how traits are passed from parents to offspring. And with the understanding that male and female contribute co-equally to their offspring comes the discipline of genetics. The first understanding of, or documented understanding of, transmission of those traits was Gregor Mendel in the late 1800s when he performed his experiments with breeding peas and looking at seed characteristics. At that time, then, the transmission of traits was really considered a philosophical concept. And we didn't know what physically underlay that. And one has, over the early 20th century, an evolution of thought as people begin to look at other organisms and the transmission of traits from parents to offspring. The discipline of clinical or medical genetics does not arise within medicine until the 1950s. Hmm. And then diagnostic testing arises in the late 1960s and proceeds forward from there as increasing understanding of what the physical component of transmission of traits was, and that resided in the DNA and genes that are encoded in the DNA. So that's the material, the instructions that's transmitted from the parent via the sperm or the egg to the offspring. So really, genetics is then, in terms of human inheritance, the transmission of instructions from mother and father to their children that define how their bodies grow and develop.
Hmm. So the Genome Project, explain to me and in terms that maybe I can understand how that's grown and where we're at in that process and what are we learning from it?
Yeah, so the Genome Project began in the late 1980s and extended into the early 2000s. And that was in having understood that DNA is the source of these instructions that mother and father transmit to their children. The objective of the Genome Project was to take a person and say, what constitutes the entirety of that DNA, and can we read or identify the instructions that are transmitted that the body uses to grow and develop? So the first sequencing of the human genome then occurred beginning from the late 1980s through the early 2000s when they announced, quote unquote, completion of the Human Genome Project. What we came quickly to realize with the completion of that is that there is no single human genome. Every person's genome is unique. So that's why one can say there's a completion of the project, but there never is a completion of a given person's genome per se, right? Because every person is different.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and that, you know, is pretty much obvious to us when we sit in a room. If you enter the room accepting identical twins who inherited the same genetic material from their parents, you don't usually have trouble recognizing one person or distinguishing them from others. And that is attributable in large part to the unique genome that each person has. If we understand then that all people have a unique genome, the question then comes, how did this uniqueness arise? How did this variability arise? And what we now understand is that any two sperm a person produces or any two eggs that a person produces are different. So the scribe that copies the instructions to make the egg or to make the sperm introduces errors into the genetic instructions. And whether, you know, if you have to use the word error loosely, but that is the variation, then that leads to the distinctness of each person. On occasion, that variability or those errors will impact a instruction that's considered essential or is essential, and that results in an inherited disorder.
What I'm wondering is, as we look at 2017, what are we kind of excited about could come next? You know, what are sort of the things that, you know, we're seeing the potential or the possibility for in genetic research right now?
So there's a few things that flow out of this work and research. One of those is in terms of answering the age-old human question of why am I who I am? So if a person has a problem, or I have a problem, one of the things I strive to understand is why do I have this problem? This type of testing provides an answer to that, that here's the variation that caused this trait in your family or you to be different than others in your family and to have whatever the trait or problem might be that's of concern. So we have increasing understanding of this and ability to give answers back to individuals for that. The next, go ahead.
What's the relationship? How accurate is that right now? Do we know specifically if you have this variation that there's a direct correlation? Or are we still trying to figure out how all those pieces fit?
So in those genes or instructions that are deemed essential, the correlation is quite tight. So is it always 100% that if you have a given change that the person will become ill? No. Are they predisposed to be having a problem or the trait? Yes. So this can guide preventive measures. If one knew that he or she was at risk of something, one could alter lifestyle, alter diet, undergo surveillance measures for early detection of the problem, and if the problem occurs, then intervention or therapy can be implemented earlier. So this then allows some control or better outcomes for individuals. The other part is, go ahead.
I was just going to say to our listeners who might be just tuning in, we're talking to genetics researcher Dr. Cornelius Burkle from Sanford. Go ahead, Dr. Burkle, finish your thought.
Okay. So in addition, we have other disorders that arise from mismatch between who we are and how we're living today. So we come from a background of organisms or humans that were very mobile and active as hunter-gatherers. Today, we live in a culture that is largely urban and sedentary by comparison to our ancestors. So the other part that's coming out of this is an understanding of why we are not matched to our current cultural environment and what changes we might need to make to our lifestyles to improve our overall health. So this is a current area of a very active investigation and is called precision prevention, which is under investigation by many public health programs to try to improve the health of the population.
Precision prevention. Then do you need to know your specific sort of genetic makeup to make full use of that, or is that a general public health conversation?
It's a general public health conversation because many of those genetic characteristics are weak in the sense that there's not an alteration of an essential gene, but many small alterations that add up together to have allowed us to do well as hunter-gatherers in the past and not do quite so well in our current urban environment. So that would be an example of that. Another part of precision prevention is understanding these subtle variations that predispose us to having reactions, adverse reactions to various drugs. So that's called pharmacogenetics. So pharmacy or pharmaceutical and genetics. So one physicians use that information to try to identify which drugs are safest for the patient.
How quickly is all this evolving? And I'm wondering if the public policy and sort of the ethics conversations of this is keeping up with what we're learning on the medical research side.
Well, they're going hand in hand. So there's constant discussion around ethics and public policy of when is something deemed medically actionable, what education needs to accompany the release of results. So these are ongoing conversations. But like all cultural shifts, there's certain components that will lag and others that will lead. In this case, technology is and ability to sequence or read the genetic instructions is pulling the wagon, as one might say, and ethics and public policy discussion are chasing rapidly behind.
Where are patients or consumers of healthcare, if you will, sort of falling on that continuum? Is this something that we need to be asking ourselves about, who do we share this, information with and what they're going to do with it? What do we need to know as individuals about where this is at right now and where it might be going in the immediate future?
So this is a very personal question that I, you know, no one can specify what the right or wrong answer is for any given individual. And what one often observes is that within different areas of the world and different areas of the country, there are different norms for the answer to that question. So one can, if one looks at Silicon Valley, where people love to have as much information about themselves as possible, many of them participate in having their genome sequenced. Other people are more private, and or they prefer not to know that information, and they don't participate. But that is a discussion that individuals have to have with themselves, and then also consider that they may uncover information that's of utility to their family, and if they knew that information, what would they say to their family, or how would they convey that?
Mm. Dr. Cornelius Berkel is Executive Director of Sanford Imagenetics Research Center on Genomic and Molecular Medicine. He's also Executive Clinical Director of Sanford Genetics Laboratories. Dr. Berkel, thanks so much for the background and your time. We hope to talk to you again in the future.
Thank you.
Continue our conversation. Let's keep the conversation going now about genetics. Our guest is Joe Irichetta. He's a genetic researcher with Missouri Breaks Industrial Research. Joe is joining us from Kadoka. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Now, I have in the studio, if you could see me now, these piles of papers about genetics research and ethics and privacy and public policy, and I'm sort of buried by it. So we're going to assume that lots of our listeners are feeling the same sense of overwhelm. We talked to our last guest about some of the history and basics of genetic research, and I'm wondering if you and I could sort of start off where we left off with this notion of ethics and privacy, personal issues, but also public policy issues. So let's talk about where we're at now. What are you seeing?
So I don't know if you're aware, but George W. Bush signed into law a piece of legislation. I can't remember the name of it, Research and Discovery for America. And it basically was the beginning of this endeavor to try and make science work for economic benefit for the United States. And part of that has become this interest in genomics and omics in general. So there's many omics. There's epigenomics, there's metabolomics, there's proteomics, all these different things that have to do from when the gene codes for a protein until the protein starts to do its job until it has some sort of effect in the human body. And these things, as you've seen with Joseph Biden and Barack Obama, have been written into incentive policies for precision medicine and the cancer moonshot. Mm-hmm. And as good as those things are, sort of like the analogy they're making to going to the moon, at spurring a lot of innovation and discovery, at the same time, putting them into public practice is a whole different ballgame. The science is still fairly new, and as the last caller suggested, the regulations are also new or non-existent. It's, for a lot of different technological developments, including things like self-driving cars, the regulations cannot keep up. I mean, it's just going far too quickly. And in terms of predictability for genomics, so far the case has been very poor. In fact, other things like epigenomics and microbiota, microbiome studies have been shown to have a lot more predictive value than genomics in particular.
Hmm. So what kind of questions, what are the smart questions we need to be asking ourselves as citizens and patients and family members right now when we start hearing these words thrown out in, you know, in the media about Washington and in the doctor's office?
Well, a lot of the conversation has been about the GINA, the genomics information non-discriminatory act,
right.
Which is kind of like a HIPAA law, which protects the patient's privacy and the privacy of the family, and those are good things. The thing about genetics that's different from other medical tests, say like an HIV test or paternity test, in those cases, an HIV test only affects that particular individual if there's some sort of data breach. If it's a paternity test, it only affects the triad of the mom and the dad and the child. But in genetics, it affects you, it affects your family, your cousins, and potentially your group. If you're from a group like American Indians, where they're very highly related to each other and they're small and they're isolated, then you are making a privacy breach for a very large group of people. So there's those issues that people talk about. But the other issue is intellectual property. So when there was a race to decode the human genome, it was a race between a private company by Craig Venter and all the other governments in NATO, basically. Hmm. And they didn't want any of this information to be privatized. So the United States led an effort with other countries from Europe and around the world to code first, because they didn't want to have this information privatized and put into the hands of the market. And since then, there's been lots and lots of attempts by different companies to try and privatize this information.
Hmm. So if you're just joining us, my guest is Joe Irichetta. Tell me a little bit about the Cheyenne River Research Symposium very quickly, because we're going to have you back on to talk about that. And then I have another question for you. But I don't want to forget that in April. Yes.
So our symposium is for the education and action of tribal communities. Mm-hmm. Research has had a unfortunate negative connotation and consequence in a lot of Native communities since probably the 1920s, and there's lots of examples of that. And so a lot of our members are afraid of it, don't understand it, don't see how it can benefit them. So our symposium will have lots of different research disciplines, you know, from business to traditional medicine, from environmental health to even things like art and history. So we're exposing broadly the community to all these research topics and the potential benefits for bolstering not only economy, but try to reinvigorate culture and language. So that's what the symposium is basically about. And this is our third year, and we're very proud of the fact that we've been able to continue this long.
And we'll bring listeners more about that as it gets a little closer. But Joe, just to wrap up for today, and I do hope you'll come back and make this part of an ongoing conversation. But as you mentioned, negative connotation in Native communities, I think a lot of people, as I look at my social media feed, are having a lot of fearful, you know, or worrisome questions about this upcoming legislation in Congress. Are we overreacting, or do we need to be particularly strident about our concerns about genetic privacy right now? What are your thoughts there?
I think that people's reactions are well founded. These types of things are unknown quantities in terms of surveillance and, like I said, intellectual property issues. And so GINA was meant to protect people from all sorts of discrimination, from insurance discrimination, from workplace harassment, from firing and hiring policies, what benefits you get, and what benefits your children get. So they might cover you as the employee, but decide because your child has some condition that they won't cover your child. So I think that right now, in terms of policy and regulation and who's protected and who's benefiting from that law that's or that bill that's being considered is something that we should be looking at a lot more closely.
All right. We're going to pay very close attention to it here. Hopefully you'll come back and we'll explore that conversation more. My guest has been Joe Irshetta, genetic researcher with Missouri Breaks Industrial Research. We reached him in Kadoka today. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.